This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
I think possibly we probably need to move to a county unitary system, get rid of all the districts. All my Conservative colleagues out there are going to be sticking pins in me now, and have a Kent unitary, much bigger tax base, and it would probably make a lot of sense. And you think, you get rid of all those CEOs, all those COOs, all those CFOs, you know, we'd save a lot of money along the way. But, you know, that's real blue sky thinking. And, you know, if I was advising Kemi Badenoch, hopefully she'll be the next leader of the Conservative Party, they're the sorts of things that I'd want her to be thinking about.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to this edition of the Kent Politics Podcast. In a week, it was disclosed there are plans to make even more roads harder to park on in a school safer street scheme. We crunched the numbers to see if Canterbury's park and ride scheme actually has any real benefit, and it emerged the number of road closures in the county has rocketed in the past 4 years to an all-time high. My name is Simon Finlay, local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and I'm joined by Robert Boddy, who looks after Medway Council.
Hello.
Daniel Liston, who covers the district and borough councils.
Hello.
And senior news editor Nikki White, who will be joining us to look at what is happening in Westminster.
Hello.
Later on, we'll be joined by our special guest, Tory Andrew Lawrence, who is the shadow spokesman on regeneration, community and housing at Medway Council. First up, Robert, what's been happening in Medway?
So regular listeners will be aware of the School Streets programme, which has been tried in various places about the county, particularly in Medway, where the original 7 schools involved in the scheme could be joined by another 9 schools.
Can you just remind us what the rules are around these school streets and what are the new schools being introduced?
So the basic gist is that during certain hours around the start and end of the school day, cars are banned from driving down certain streets around selected schools. Residents on the street can get an exemption, as do emergency vehicles, but anyone who ignores the restriction is hit with a fine. The new schools to be included are Crest Infant and Nursery School, Dels Academy, St William of Perth Catholic Primary School and King's Pre and Preparatory School in Rochester, Hilltop Primary School in Frinsbury, Cliffwoods Primary School and Lee Academy High Holstow Primary Academy on the Hoo Peninsula, St Margaret's Infant School, St Margaret's Church of England Junior School and Fairview Community Primary in Raynham. Horsted Primary in Chatham will also be included. These are all out for a public consultation at the moment, and on top of this, the council is also working with New Horizons Children's Academy and Holcombe Grammar School in Chatham on an additional school street proposal, which will go to public consultation at a later date.
The council's obviously pretty keen on this scheme. What do the residents think of it?
So you're right, the council says the scheme has been really successful improving the safety for children walking to school, and say if people don't want to get fined, then they shouldn't just break the rules. Some residents are less convinced. There are those who want the changes and think that the amount of cars travelling through areas where children are, often not being conscious they need to be more careful. There are also those who think it will just push the problem into other streets rather than fixing it altogether.
What have you been looking at then, Dan?
So I've been doing sums and crunching numbers on Canterbury City Council's park and ride service, which reopening this was a flagship policy of the Labour Lib Dem coalition, but the first regular report on it didn't look particularly good, basically.
Yeah, always a very controversial subject, park and rides. Yeah, so what's the background? Why was part of it shut?
Canterbury's had a park and ride for ages, pretty much as long as I can remember, with 3 sites where people can park up outside the city, park their cars there, and then get buses into the city centre rather than drive. But in 2022, one of these 3 sites at Sturry Road was shuttered by the previous Tory council, who pointed out it was the least popular park and ride location and it was too expensive to run. But before last year's election, Labour and the Lib Dems wanted it reopened, and after taking over the council, they voted to do just that. And it was up and running again this April. But when they voted to reopen it, they also committed to sending reports to be heard at council meetings every 6 months on the performance of that park and ride. And the first batch of those came out and it opened them up to quite a bit of criticism.
This little while into it, what are the numbers like?
So basically, bear in mind, this is just for the site at Sturry Road, not for the rest of the park and ride service. But from April to July, an average of only 89 cars parked up at the site to use the buses into the city. And there are about 70 to 80 bus journeys serving that site every day. So it's near enough one-for-one buses or cars replaced with buses. Based on the cost of a journey and the cost of the whole park and ride contract with Stagecoach, we worked out that that means the Surrey Road site is losing just under £30,000 a month, or about £900 a day. On top of that, you know, obviously the goal of the park and ride is largely environmental and parking based. You know, it's to reduce emissions from car journeys and parking in the city centre. But the council's own report says that the whole park and ride service is probably producing 140 tonnes more CO2 than it's actually saving.
So what have people in charge said about it, and why is it doing so badly?
The administration has said, yeah, they're pretty open. There's a long way to go. They need to do more marketing. They want to consider some new discount permits for businesses and the like to encourage more people to use it. But they've also been saying for a long time their goal is to just to reduce the amount of traffic and people parking in the city centre. Park and Ride is a big part of that. And yeah, they point out if you see Park and Ride as part of the whole parking service, which they do, it makes a profit of about 5 million quid for the council. So this loss isn't the end of the world to them, really. In terms of why it's failing, a lot of it is probably for reasons which are totally out of the control of a local council. You know, for decades, British design and other policy has explicitly prioritised cars over other forms of public transport, and buses in particular have a well-earned reputation for unreliability. So most people simply don't want to risk getting one. In theory, you know, the new government is going to introduce legislation to allow councils to bring buses back under public control. So maybe in a year or so, all of this will look completely different. But for now, Canterbury City Council's got its work cut out.
So what's happening down your way, Simon?
Well, it's a bit of a road theme this week. So it's emerged that the number of road closures in the county has rocketed in the past 4 years to an all-time high. These come about when permits are issued by Kent County Council to utility companies and KCC itself to shut the highways temporarily. And these numbers have shot up in recent years. Much of these closures are actually unavoidable, in fairness. Say, for example, British Gas has a leak. They have to get an emergency closure to fix it. The trouble is, like water companies, much of its infrastructure is old and failing and falling to pieces. So, plus, there's other work such as broadband being installed to rural communities, potholes being fixed by KCC, and work done to facilitate the massive house building programme that's been foisted on Kent by central government.
What has KCC done about it?
Well, the Transport Cabinet Committee set up an inspectorate of a handful of people, and they have the power to go to these different sites and find breaches of the permit agreements. The chairman, Sean Holden, was incensed that a lot of emergency permits were issued but not started days after they were meant to, rather than the few hours. Often work ceases at the weekend, but the closures remain in place. Diversion signs are wrong or send people into places like cul-de-sacs. But, you know, the figures are these. In 2021, there were 6,600 closures for utilities, which has leapt to 10,296 in 2023-24, while the KCC works rose from 3,400 to 5,900 in the same period.
Is the inspectorate working?
Well, Sean Holden said the 1,300 fines have been issued this year to contractors not comply with the terms of the temporary road closure permits, but the fines total just 95,000. Councillor Holden did qualify this by saying that the average fine paid was less than £80 per breach and asked for much higher penalties in the future. Fines are nationally set and not by KCC. If Councillor Holden got his way, they'd probably be fined tens of thousands of pounds for every single breach until the perpetrators got the message. He also added that every mile of KCC's network of 5,500 miles of roads, that's how much it is, are now being closed on an average of three times a year. The upshot is that the road closures are going to carry on, but at least there's a team of people trying to ensure that disruption is kept to a minimum by enforcing the rules around the permits. Nikki, what's caught your eye from the national political scene this week?
So the big thing this week is the Labour Party conference in Liverpool, where Sir Keir Starmer has given his first conference speech as Prime Minister. As you might expect, he was greeted with thunderous applause by a largely welcoming audience. There was one heckler who was swiftly dealt with. But as speeches go, it was perhaps understandably cautious in its tone. I think if he'd come out all guns blazing with a "well done us, we won the election" attitude, he would have completely missed the mark with most of the electorate. We're nervous. People voted for change and want it, but it doesn't always make you terribly comfortable when it happens. As it turns out, I think he seemed to get the balance of his speech right, recognising all the hard work Labour supporters had put in ahead of the election, and summing up the responsibility the party now has to continue to earn the trust of those who voted them in, and along with those who didn't. The big theme running through his hour-long speech was change, how there's much change ahead, but how it's already happening with things such as the creation of the National Wealth Fund, changes to the way planning decisions are made so that we can get going with building 1.5 million new homes, and setting up the Great British Energy to create good jobs and cut people's bills, while also agreeing deals to end national strikes. He also kept coming back to the importance of service and how the government is there to serve the people. Country first, party second was a phrase he came back to a couple of times.
That's what he's been repeating for quite some time. Do you think he revealed much about what lies ahead in like actual concrete policy terms?
There wasn't a great deal of detail about what we can expect in the coming months, but Sir Keir did reveal something called the Hillsborough Law is going to be introduced by next April, and that's in recognition of the 97 people who died at the fatal crash in Sheffield in April 1989. The law will create a legal duty of candour on public authorities and officials to tell the truth and proactively cooperate with official investigations and inquiries, or they're going to face criminal sanctions. He said the law would not only help deliver justice for Hillsborough families, but also the victims of the Post Office Horizon scandal, the Infected Blood scandal, the Windrush scandal and the Grenfell Tower tragedy. He said the key issue for going forward now would be to stabilise our economy as the first step of Labour's long-term plan. But he warned it's not going to be easy, and he knows at times he's not going to be popular. He told the conference that things are worse than we ever imagined. In the first few weeks, Labour discovered a £22 billion black hole in the public finances. He did allude to the controversial cut to pensioners and winter fuel payments. He said it wasn't something he wanted to do. It was something that he had to if this long-term goal was going to be achieved. Other things he said would be tackled would be a crackdown on knife crime, a 10-year plan for our NHS, bringing our railway back into public ownership, more teachers, more neighbourhood police, housing for all veterans who need it, along with young care leavers and victims of domestic abuse, and of course, how we control migration.
So it all went off without a hitch?
Unfortunately, he didn't get to the end of his speech without one slip up. While repeating his call for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, he also asked for the return of the sausages. Thankfully, he quickly corrected that to hostages, which had been taken by Hamas. But generally speaking, it was a speech recognising what's wrong at the moment, but a warning that it's going to be a bumpy road ahead for all of us.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
Andrew Lawrence joined Medway Council at the local elections in 2023 and serves within the Shadow Cabinet as the Tory spokesperson for regeneration, community and housing. Anyone who has observed a Medway Council meeting or seen Medway's political debate on social media will likely be aware he's not afraid to speak his mind or challenge the Labour Council and now Labour government. Here to speak his mind for our benefit, Councillor Andrew Lawrence, welcome.
Hi.
So first of all, let's get a bit about your background. Tell us a bit about it.
Yeah, so I'm born in 1966. I'm South East London born and bred. I went from Brixton to Grove Park in SE12, where I spent a long time. Went to school locally, in primary school, secondary school. I went to a very special school, the London Nautical School, which was a school that came out a direct result of the Titanic disaster. It was the place where boys wanting to a pre-sea education could go and be educated. So that was a really important part of my life. And for a long time, I wanted to join the Royal Navy. But instead, I ended up in insurance broking in the City of London. My political journey really starts in what we used to call the fifth year. I think they call it year 11 these days. And I became quite politically aware, and it was the period of the Thatcher period. Mm-hmm. And Mrs. Thatcher really meant something to me. And the school I went to, even though it had a lot of boys who went into the military, Royal Marines, Royal Navy, Royal Fleet Auxiliary, it was in the old Inner London Education Authority. And quite a few of the teachers were definitely very left-leaning. And I do remember that I think my history teacher was Red Ted Knight's press secretary, and Red's head used to run Lambeth Council, real lefty. So yeah, I sort of cut my teeth there, and I think if you cut me in half now, you'd find Conservative all the way through. Mm. I've never ever voted for anyone else. I've had to grit my teeth voting Conservative occasionally, but I've never thought about voting anyone else. And I think my political philosophy really comes out of the Thatcher period. Mm.
So, I mean, that's quite noticeable from a lot of the stuff you post on social media. You do share a lot of sort of quotes from her and that sort of thing. What is it that she represents to you, do you think?
I think she represents that move from a Britain that was almost socialist, not quite socialist, that was on its backside. You know, the days when we had to beg money from the IMF,
the constant strikes. I mean, I remember sitting at home the four-day week, you know, we had power strikes all the time, the dead were unburied and the rubbish was piled 12 feet high in the street. And I think she brought that new vision of freedom, liberty, and for her it was the freedom from government that actually really was important. I don't think she ever got to complete her mission, to be fair. And, you know, she still had wets in the cabinet who colluded against her. But I do think that was a massive change to Britain. And I think what I worry about at the moment is Starmer wants more state and wants to take us back to the days of the Labour government of the 70s where the state makes all the decision for you and we're going to lose those freedoms.
I wanted to ask, actually, you said you got into politics at secondary school and basically became a bit of a Thatcherite then. Was it just a sort of, you know, capital C Conservative Party politics and Thatcher thing, or was 16-year-old Andrew Lawrence reading, you know, Hayek and Rothbard and that kind
of
thing?
No, I wish I could, yeah, if I was to be really dishonest, I'd say of course I was reading Hayek and Friedrich and, you know, lots of other, Milton Friedman, for example. But actually, I think my journey, as I've got older, I've got more conservative, but less Thatcherite.
Right.
So for me, my values are more conservative. So therefore, you know, I'd put family and country and possibly God at the forefront of everything I'm thinking about. But I think when you come from the 70s, it is about liberty, low taxes, small government. I'm still a small government conservative. Mm. I think that, you know, the biggest disaster we could inflict on the country now is more civil servants, more state, more taxes. But also my political journey, I mean, I was first elected as a councillor in 1990, I think, from memory, as a Lewisham councillor. And I stood two terms in my 20s, and I was quite young. But I suppose I learned how to brawl, because when you're in my second term, I was the last Conservative on Lewisham Council. And that was a real challenge. But and I also think what's very interesting about that period is that's the period of John Major, Maastricht, and the Conservative Party imploding again. And now we're in a period where the Conservative Party has imploded and we're arguing about, you know, lots of things about what it is to be Conservative. But you do, I think when you're in a situation like I was in the London Borough of Lewisham, is that you do, it makes you believe what you believe. But can I just say, local government, local politics is probably 80 to 90% common sense, 10% politics.
Yeah. And so, I mean, obviously you said you were sort of quite a political teenager, quite politically minded, but what took you to make that step to actually stand for a local government?
Well, I'd been involved in Young Conservatives, both in Lewisham, and I'd lived for a few years in South Suffolk, which was Tim Yeo's constituency. When I moved back to South East London, I was very much involved in the local associations, and I campaigned for Colin Moynihan, and also campaigned for local council elections. So that's what really got me. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, I think the difference between Conservatives and Labour in terms of finding their candidates, the Labour, there are more Labour people who are more motivated to stand for local authorities. I think Conservatives, you tend to be in business or running your own business, or you tend to have a job that makes it very difficult for you to do that. If you're a teacher or a nurse or a trade unionist, it's easier to be able to find the time to become a Conservative. But I genuinely think I was given a tap on the shoulder and said, Andrew, would you like to stand in St Mildred's Ward, which is where I live? And I think that's really important if the councillors, if possible, should live in the ward they represent. And that's why I, you know, I live in Hempstead and I represent Hempstead and Wigmore. So yeah, you know, Conservative, typical tap on the shoulder, would you like to stand? And I got elected.
So I mentioned in the intro, you're not afraid to speak your mind. You have some strong opinions, I think that's fair to say. I mean, do you think, I mean, meetings can get pretty heated sometimes. It's not just all from your side, of course. You know, other Labour councillors can be equally strident. I mean, do you think that is productive in the debate around politics?
I think it makes politics more interesting.
Certainly does,
Because, you know, would you guys turn up to meetings if they were all just, everyone was just nodding and patting each other on the back? Look, number one, I hope I'm never personal, okay? I'll have a pop at someone for their politics, but I won't have a pop about them. I think what I find with the Labour group, and there are certain councillors who make it very personal. You know, Councillor Murray would never have a friend who was a Conservative. And yet I'm as polite as possible with Councillor Murray. Not that she ever always responds in likewise. But, you know, people like Councillor Maple, Vince Maple, I mean, this guy's given up a lot of his years for Medway. I don't agree with him on a lot of things. You know, don't think he's leading a particularly competent administration. But I admire that he's given everything he has to the people in Medway. And I think as long as we keep sight of those things. That's what's really important. Going back to my point about local politics is 80 or 90% common sense. Mm. I think there are few things to argue about at ONS, more things to argue about at full council because they tend to be more political. So yeah, we'll have motions and questions, and then we have to put up with the leader's report, which is always some sort of fantasy story that Vince has cocked up on his way to council. And I think they're the opportunities for the politics of it. But also, you know, you've got three councillors who are now MPs. These three councillors all agreed with Keir Starmer's winter fuel policy. You know, we've got to hold them to account.
Now, speaking of sort of your view of local government, I mean, you wrote an article for Conservative Home about reforming local government finance, which you argued that the cap on council tax increases, which is about 5% each time, should be lifted. And you suggest that the property-based council taxes should be replaced with a local income tax. Can you explain sort of where these ideas come from and why they're necessary?
Yeah, okay. So I think first and foremost, when you cap anything, it has other impacts. So first of all, it's when you talk about local government, it's not very democratic. Because why is it only 30% of people bother to vote at local authority? Because they're not affected by what we do here in terms of tax. Tax is the big thing that drives people to come out and vote.
Yeah.
Almost always. So these ideas I've had for some time, and I was looking, you know, I got an opportunity to put them down on paper. So, you know, property-based taxes don't take any real account of your ability to pay. So you have pensioners who are asset rich but cash poor are paying for, you know, band D, band E, band F council tax. Also, property taxes mean that there are a segment of working adults who aren't paying anything towards local services but still consuming them. Mm. So, you know, what's the alternative? So we've tried the poll tax, and actually, in fact, you know, what was called, well, I should really call it the community charge, of course. But the poll tax, actually, when you think about it, was a policy that was flat rated. Every adult in an area paid that amount towards the services that they use, whether it be repairing street lighting, maintaining our green spaces. However, it failed. So we have to look at something else. With a local income tax, the technology's moved on now. So I think, as I said in the article, HMRC receive monthly salary data from every single employer in the country. So therefore, the ability to say, let's replace council tax with a local income tax, the technology already exists. All a local authority's got to do is tell HMRC that every adult in this area will pay a 1% local income tax, and HMRC, it will be deducted as part of your PAYE contributions. So anyone who might be worried that your local authority will get to seal your tax affairs, that just doesn't exist. And also the savings are potentially immense. No more collecting money at the local authority level. No more rates department, you know. And also the collection rates could well be a lot higher because the money's been deducted from salary by employers.
But, I mean, a possible argument against that would be areas that are very wealthy. So some London boroughs that have you know, a high amount of wealth there, very rich, you know, earners. People would be paying, yes, more tax probably, but then less reliant upon public services than people who, earn a lot less. And areas where there's a high amount of people who earn less, would their services would suffer, wouldn't they not?
Yeah, look, at the end of the day, wherever you go in the country, there'll be wealthy areas, there'll be less wealthy areas. Mm. There'll be, you know, in Medway we have the centre of Rochester is very wealthy. Mm. My bit of where I live is reasonably wealthy. But there are bits in central Chatham that appear very high in the deprivation indexes.
Yeah.
The thing about it is local authorities need to collect a certain amount of revenue to provide the services that people need. So even you go to those wealthy areas, let's go to Bournemouth, for example, where there's a very elderly population. Mm-hmm. So yes, those people probably own, a lot of people own their own homes. They are retired. They're getting a pension and everything else. But actually, can you imagine the strain on providing services at home?
Mm.
So this is not about wealthy areas and poor areas. It will be, in my view, it'll be for the local authorities to set the budget that they want for the services they want to provide based on their election manifesto, and they will levy a local income tax in order to meet that. And then every working adult is caught by that local income tax. I think more people will come out and vote. And I think what's important here is that profligate Labour authorities will spend loads and loads of money on lots of vanity projects and lots of projects that we won't be able to see a lot of value in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, more finance-aware Conservatives can come up with different budgets, and there it becomes a real point of difference. And that's the debate we need to have. One other thing on this. Government has put more and more statutory responsibility onto local authorities. Let's talk about adult social care, for example, SEND provision. There is more and more, but there's been less and less money coming from central government to fund this. Mm-hmm. At some point, for me, and I think I said this very clearly, is I want, as a councillor, I want to be able to provide the services people want, but I also want to have some money in order to invest in the people and place. At the moment, we're basically social services, a bit of rubbish collection. We cut the hedges every now and then and the grass every now and then, but there's not an awful lot of money to do anything else. And if we really want to transform Medway, then I think we need a different form of government finance. One other point. There's always another point. The thing about it is if we depend, I think the budget's about 400, let's call it £450 million. It's a nice round number. Yeah. Only about £175 million is coming from council taxpayers.
Right.
The rest of it is entirely dependent on government. As a Conservative, I believe the decision-making and tax-raising powers should be as close to the people who use those services as possible. When you've got, how do the Americans call it? The tyranny of the federal government. Mm-hmm. We've got a similar tyranny now. God forbid Angela Rayner's going to be making decisions on how much money local governments have going forward. There's an even worse tyranny than one we had under Michael Gove. But I do think, you know, local people deciding what services they want and how they pay for it, that's the important thing. Mm-hmm. I do think the problem with part of my system is that, and you remember this is very much a personal view, but I hope it sparks a debate. I've had some really stupid comments on Twitter from Medway Labour, but I didn't expect much else, to be honest. But I want a debate on this, but I do think it throws up maybe a wider reorganisation of local governments required. Can we still have small authorities like Medway? So we're an upper tier authority with 275,000 people in it, trying to provide the services we're trying to provide. I think possibly we probably need to move to a county unitary system, get rid of all the districts. All my Conservative colleagues out there are going to be sticking pins in me now, and have a Kent unitary, much bigger tax base, and it would probably make a lot of sense. And you think, you get rid of all those CEOs, all those COOs, all those CFOs, you know, we'd save a lot of money along the way. But, you know, that's real blue sky thinking. And, you know, if I was advising Kemi Badenoch, hopefully she'll be the next leader of the Conservative Party, they're the sorts of things that I'd want her to be thinking about.
Well, I was just going to ask, obviously you mentioned a benefit of local government reform would be basically reduction in bureaucracy and the amount of unelected people in the employ of local government. But do you not think that, you know, the reason why there's such a glut of bureaucratic and management positions in local government is because successive governments, starting with Thatcher, have made it so that local government, you know, you don't run your own buses anymore, you have to have people who liaise with private bus companies. You don't run many of your own local services anymore, you have to have all these bureaucrats who are completely unelected to take responsibility for services which the voting public are responsible for. Surely, you know, the Thatcherite revolution is pretty responsible for the glut of bureaucracy and management which you think is such a problem in the state and local government.
No. I don't agree with that point of view at all. Good try. Look, what Thatcher wanted local authorities to do is to be less of a provider of a service and more of a manager of services provided by a range of different organisations. So not everything would be provided directly by the council. What's happened, you know, my analysis of it is when you look at the big property scandals that have hit a number of local authorities around the country, I think Woking was probably one of the big ones. Croydon was another big one, where they set up commercial organisations, borrowed heavily, bought commercial property, another property, and it's all just gone horribly wrong. Was it Thurrock Council bought a solar farm? Mm. Didn't even go see it. Like, no one even went to see it. I think there are massive dangers because all of that sits on the council's balance sheet. So if you look at Medway, we've got our LAC, what they called LACCOs, local authority trading companies. So we've got MDC and Kindy. Now, actually, MDC, the purpose behind it wasn't just about raising additional revenue, or it has raised additional revenue. It was about doing that more difficult development that the developers wouldn't take on because it was just too risky. But for me, I would much rather the council be the commissioning services, whether some of those will be internal, because sometimes you can only do them internally, some of them will be external, but the job of the council is to find that balance between value for money and service that actually means we deliver the service people want. Some of the procurement rules are there to stop bribery and corruption. You know, I still think I can remember the 70s and, you know, it always used to be lots of scandals there. The council itself does not have to provide every service, in my view. So, for example, buses. Would we really trust Medway Labour to run the buses in Medway? I mean, Arriva aren't doing a particularly good job and they're a professional bus company. So, you know, do we really want local councillors to be running buses? Without the problem with, you know, just that on that public transport side is that without, you know, big investments and public subsidy, buses are always going to be patchy. So these are the sorts of decisions that actually a local, now, could a local authority like Medway, if it was had an uncapped ability to raise revenue, it could say to its residents as a part of its manifesto, we want to run 30% more buses and that's going to cost us 10 million quid and we're going to put that on the local income tax. Mm. That then becomes something for people to vote on. And I think that's good democracy. That's absolutely good democracy.
One thing that we were talking earlier between ourselves was about around this freebie scandal with Keir Starmer and stuff like that. And a lot of people, a lot of discussion about, you know, why do the people make these donations? Why do people accept these donations? And one of the arguments that we were discussing was, well, what if MPs, but even councillors and local councillors, aren't paid enough? And you say you increase how much they get paid, but you say you're not allowed to accept any donations whatsoever. I mean, in taking it to a local level as well, we also discussed sort of making councillors sort of like a full-time position. Yeah. It would open it up to a lot of people who possibly can't do that. I mean, what are your sorts of views on that?
So it's an interesting one. I think yes and yes. Okay, I think if we went to a bigger, say, bigger unitary authority, as we were just discussing, I think there would be a strong case for full-time elected members. But, you know, you could manage that by limiting the number of members, for example. And you've got to remember, a lot of our counties and our wards are designed in the days when we had horse and cart and there was no internet and getting around was, you know, much more difficult. I think the whole, you know, free gear, Keir, it's the best one, but it doesn't roll off the tongue. I think what it's opened up is there's a lot of hypocrisy on the left. You know, they've been doing this. It does still bring into sharp focus some of the scandals that affected the Conservative Party. And I reflect a lot on those. I've never taken a donation in my life standing for local government. And I think the rules are so, I think under the rules, if I have anything over £100, I have to declare it. Mm. But I could envisage a time if we were going to big unitaries, then you might have full-time councillors.
Right. Just on a final topic, you mentioned earlier Kemi Badenoch is your preferred choice for the Tory leadership contest. What is it that she's offering that you like?
I think she talks authentically about real conservative values, albeit, you know, she is, you know, as a member of the previous cabinet, she has to take some responsibility for what happened. All four candidates who are standing and we'll be talking at a party conference next week, I think it is, are, you know, good people. But I think Kemi speaks authentically about conservatism, about family. She's talked a lot about family. She's talking a lot about young people. And I think she can also talk authentically about some of the issues around immigration. But I would expect to see all four candidates in a shadow cabinet. And whoever wins the party leadership needs to bring the party together. But we've had 14 years of One Nation conservatism. And I don't think it's worked out very well.
Is there something about our fellow man of Kent, Tom Tugendhat, that explicitly turns you off then?
I just don't warm to him. He just doesn't talk to me as my type of conservative. Tom's got some, you know, phenomenal skills, and I think he'll be an excellent member of the shadow cabinet. Just at this point, I don't see too much I have in common with Tom. James Cleverly, Lewisham boy. And, you know, James Cleverly's background is, you know, setting up his own business, which is exactly what I've done. You know, I own my own business. He's done that. But I just, once again, I just think he lacks a certain, what is it I'm looking for? It's a certain passion that Kemi Badenoch speaks to. Mm.
And, I mean, whoever wins the leadership contest is going to face sort of two main problems, which is Keir Starmer's got this big majority, so he can kind of do whatever he really wants. And the sort of Conservative Party, although they are the second largest party, they're kind of an irrelevancy in that sense. But the second...
That's fighting something there, Robert.
But the second point is that, you know, anybody who says we should change, go in a majorly different direction, or the Prime Minister should do this or that, the common response is always going to be, well, why didn't you do that over the 14 years that you were in charge? I mean, how do you respond to this?
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, any leader, I think all four of our candidates have stood in the previous cabinet. So they all bear some responsibility for the position we're in. I think Robert Jenrick did an honourable thing and he resigned, but he was looking after the immigration brief, and that was a really tough brief, because at the end of the day, not only was he fighting certain parts of the Conservative Party, and fighting the Home Office and, you know, all the NGOs that want to have open borders here. So I reject the left-right movement. For me, there are Conservatives with real strong Conservative values. I don't see those as right-wing. Okay, so I totally reject anyone who comes forward. The Conservative Party is being dragged to the right in order to take on reform. So what we have to bear in mind is we have to have, you know, a lot of people who voted reform, and I spoke to a lot of these people. I also did in 2019 when I stood in Watling Ward, and that was in the middle of the May debacle, Theresa May trying to sort Brexit out badly. And a lot of those people said, I am not voting for you because the Conservative Party has let me down. And I think that's the position. So what I'm hoping, whoever comes up with conservative policies, these are not right-wing policies, but they play into what I consider our core values, and that will attract people back. But I don't underestimate the job that person's got to do in order to build the trust back with those voters who left us. Just remember, in Medway, the three Labour candidates only won because of reform. Half of their majority is half of the reform vote. So let's not believe that people came out in droves to vote for Labour. Actually, people came out in droves to vote for reform, and that's where we're at. So, and you know, what's very interesting, never has a party new to government imploded quite so quickly as Tugia and his mates, you know. And, you know, I'm hoping, I'll use this opportunity now to ask Vince Maple to call the three by-elections he's putting off to replace his three MPs. You know, why is he hiding? Let's get them out. Let's have them in October. Because, you know, Conservatives here in Medway and in Kent are ready for the fight.
Thank you very much for your time today, Andrew, and I hope we'll speak again soon.
Thanks, Robert.
OK, it seems the political lexicon has adopted a new word in the last few weeks. Freebies, of all the things that could possibly upset a brand new government or anger the public more, is someone getting something for nothing. Why does this get people's goats so much? Dan?
Well, I mean, the first obvious answer is that normal people don't get free tickets to Taylor Swift. They don't get their suits or glasses bought for them by anyone. And, you know, normal people also aren't earning 90-something grand a year like most MPs are. And the new government has been beset by accusations of taking all these freebies and declaring or not declaring them properly. But it sort of belies the fact that this is a, you know, good or bad, this is a completely normal part of politics. This has been the case for many, many years that politicians get free stuff. If you look at the Parliamentary Register of Interest, every time it's released, you see this MP got, you know, £2,000 of hospitality from the Betting and Gambling Council, which is one of the biggest lobbyists in Parliament. This person got a free trip to wherever. It's pretty normal. The problem is that to most normal members of the public, this is basically perceived as like naked bribery. There must be a legitimate political argument for why this is allowed to happen from politicians. They might say, oh, you know, it's legitimate that they're trying to seek the access to politicians. But Labour politicians accused of this haven't actually been making this argument. They've basically just been saying, well, I declared it within the rules and therefore it's fine. They haven't cut to the base of the political issue, which is they need to justify why it is perfectly legitimate for MPs to be given all this free stuff when, you know, if somebody wants to lobby a politician, they should, you know, simply find the time for them, and a politician should decide whether they want to hear it or not.
So, Nikki, do you just think it's all part of the cut and thrust of parliamentary politics?
Well, it certainly is at the moment. Whether that should change, I don't know how I feel about it. I mean, we all like a freebie, and
journalists are bad as anybody.
Journalists are bad as anybody at some things. You know, we all like to feel that we're getting something at least through a bargain, if not free. But I also don't. I think as long as they are declaring and not taking the mickey, the difficult thing is that rules need to be laid down and rules need to be followed. And as long as they're following those rules, that's fine. I don't have an issue with somebody taking a freebie if they're upfront about it and not doing it every single week. You know, if somebody is taking the odd treat here and there, and maybe by going to that Taylor Swift concert, they're making a good deal for me and the other electorate further down the line. I think that's absolutely fine. But if you're out every single single night of the week, just schmoozing and not producing anything out of it and doing something productive, well, that's just a different thing altogether.
And what about, you know, £2,000 for a pair of glasses? Do you think that's really... I mean, that's a donation from, you know, a Labour supporter to the Prime Minister to, you know, give him a bit of a makeover. Is that the sort of thing that really chimes well with people who live in Rotherham?
I think you probably need to ask yourself, do you really need a £2,000 pair of glasses? If you can go to your local optician and buy something exactly the same for £70, then no, you should not be accepting a £2,000 pair of glasses.
Or five quid for the ones I'm wearing. You're also going to be able to see the scripts.
If any generous supporters of the podcast do have any fancy glasses going, we are open to suggestions.
Well, I mean, it does bring us onto that sort of other sort of vexed question that's been debated time and time again. If you pay our MPs properly, you'll attract the kind of talent that you need, but you'll also be able to sort of completely remove any outside work, any outside influences, and that anything you do need to go to or want to go to, you can jolly well pay for yourself. I mean, what's your feeling about that?
It's a good idea in principle, and there are many countries that do a similar sort of thing where they pay their public officials very, very well in order to stave off bribery, again, as you say, to attract those high-quality candidates. I think the problem with it is explaining that to the British people, because you can just see the front page of some newspapers being basically saying, why are we giving these lazy politicians who just, you know, sell us out on all the issues and don't solve the country's problems, why are we giving them more money? Now, they'll won't necessarily recognise that you're doing this to attract the right people to possibly get rid of these donations. I mean, a lot of the conversation which I've seen around this Keir Starmer receiving these freebies is, well, why does he need this? He gets paid a lot of money. Why does he need somebody to buy his clothes for him, you know, and that sort of thing? But this doesn't... So if you said to someone, well, all right, well, we'll pay him more, people say, well, do they not earn enough, you know? And a similar thing was with that's come out this week is that Sue Gray gets paid more than the Prime Minister. Yeah. And in this sort of discussion, I saw there's a comparison adjusted for inflation. Neville Chamberlain was in sort of, I think, the top, sort of, I want to say, 20%, but it might even have been the top 10% of earners in the country at that time when he was Prime Minister. Whereas I think Keir Starmer's not even well, I don't know where he is, but he's certainly not as high above as Neville Chamberlain was when he was Prime Minister. Mm-hmm. So I think it would be a very hard sell. It may be the right move and it may make perfect sense, but I think it'd be a hard sell to get people to agree to it.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I mean, it does bring us on to the whole business of local government. Local government councillors, people who are elected, tend to not get paid as such. They get enough money to sort of cover, you know, the cost of petrol, the cost of their phone and stationery, the lighting at home, the time that they spend on it. But is there any argument, do you think, for maybe paying them more to attract a sort of a more professional type of politician as opposed to someone who sort of does it in between, you know, a full-time job and picking up the kids from school and having a life?
There's a strong case to be made for that, much like the point about paying politicians more so they don't have to be offered loads of free stuff. Only problem is, like Robert mentioned, is getting, you know, convincing people, you know, the public to back that, because I think there's a line in the thick of it which says most people hate politicians. They would rather you lived in a cave and never spent money on anything, which is probably the sort of median voter's opinion. So try convincing them that a councillor should be paid £35,000 a year, even if there's a good argument for it. It wouldn't be very popular.
Well, as we... our listeners will have heard in the discussion with Andrew Lawrence, he suggested that if you wanted to sort of professionalise sort of lower level of local government, you'd have to, I think a better way of doing it would have sort of three or a larger unitary covering the whole of Kent and making it a professional operation. And there are certainly arguments towards that in the sense of it would could open politics up to people who maybe can't do, as he says, give their evenings to district or borough council meetings, or, you know, make it to these discussions or spend time reading through all these papers. If it's your full-time job, you can put all that time to it. And so, you know, if you're a mum or, you know, you've got some experience somewhere else that could be useful in politics, it makes it easier to enter into that world.
Also, you know, if you've got three unity authorities, you don't have to have the districts and the boroughs and the county council, and you then aren't having to pay for quite so many sort of top-ranking officials. You would basically slim the whole thing down, give it a bit more power, give it a bit more sort of clout and heft than it currently has, and probably sort of try and sort of move it, you know, away from sort of any influence of central government in terms of funding, for example. We've seen that time and time again in recent years. Okay, folks, that's your lot for this week. Thanks to Nikki, Rob and Dan for our special guest, Andrew Lawrence. Don't forget to keep an eye on kentonline.com/politics from across the county. And you can also sign up to our newly launched politics briefing newsletter by Googling Kent Online newsletter. And finally, don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. All the best.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show with Rob Bailey on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.